concern, maybe it is The Undertaker. If The Undertaker can show the world tonight that he is worthy of being the number one contender, you know what? I really don't care. Because
I know you don't, you greedy bastard.
I'd like to see The Undertaker take that title from you and beat you from an inch of your life.
You ain't worthy of kissing my ass.
From Television City in Hollywood,
this podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following rustic exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown as taped in front of a live studio audience.
Everyone, and welcome to episode 100 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winston. And today, as you can hear from the theme song, which I like, even though there's that weird part like, too much blood and not enough guts, blah, 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 blah. It's Raw is War and the War Zone, Monday Night Raw, WWF, from June 1st, 1998. Why that particular episode? Yes, it is the show following the Over the Edge 1998 pay-per-view, which was the night before in Milwaukee. This one at the Rosemont Horizon in Rosemont, Illinois. Chicago, Illinois, if you will. And this is my favorite Monday Night Raw of all time for so many reasons. And the passion that I have for this particular show is going to come out as I go through this show. And it is a two-hour show, which I have not done before. So this may well crack the two-hour mark for a Greetings from Allentown episode, which I haven't done in anything other than the clip shows, the best ofs that I've done. But first, you can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. That is @GFAllentownPod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. More on Pro Wrestling Only coming up a little bit later in the show. If you will recall, in last week's episode, I had given thanks for there not being any major winter storms in my area. And now that we're in mid-January, that was a good thing. And that is definitely something I should not have said, because I knew it would lead to another storm of some kind. And that hit this past Saturday night and into Sunday, when I woke up and I had to go outside and move about 8 inches of snow. As it turns out, my town kind of hit the jackpot and had the high number for inches of snow when they would put it up on the news. There were other areas that got a little more, but I think there has to be like one overzealous like meteorological nerd or something who sends it in from where I live, but fine. So I go out there with the snowblower, clear everything in the driveway because it was going to rain and sleet later, which was going to just create a crusty layer of ice. More on that in a second. And I had my new Bose headphones on that were connected via Bluetooth to my iPod. And I thought, oh, wow, I can actually hear everything over the motor of the snowblower. And as I'm listening to Deacon Blues by Steely Dan, I'm like, I have officially reached peak middle-aged white guy here. I'm out using a snowblower, but with these massive headphones on, rocking out to Steely Dan as I'm doing it. However, I was corrected by someone who pointed out, no, actually, peak whitey would have been if you were sitting in your living room in front of the fireplace as you watched out the window because you were paying somebody to move the snow, and you're listening to Steely Dan inside. So I guess I'm still one step away. But the snow actually fed into a master plan that I had that I'll get into later. I had to go back out because of that aforementioned rain at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, after football had already started, and you know, moved the snow a second time because there was a crusty inch and a half, 2 inches out there again, to which I had to use the snowblower again. And I have an electric start snowblower, but I like to use the crank handle to start it because if there's ever a power outage, I want to be able to know that it will actually start for me. Well, when I did it at 4 o'clock, the damn thing broke off. The rope broke. So I had to start it via the electric starter, which is fine, but just meant I had to order a new part. And it felt like, I was like, well, thank God that this did not happen during a power outage because I would be completely screwed because my driveway is about 20 feet of going uphill and then a circle that is about 30 feet in diameter at the very top. And to try and shovel that during a major storm, especially when there's ice involved, it would have been way too much for me to do. So I go inside, I watch football, and clearly, you know, I was thrilled. Even though Vinny Vegas corner, I went 0-2, so now I'm 5-5 on the playoffs. And trying to keep my head during the Patriots game, as during the first half, I was actually putting together the intro for this show, kind of deciding the music. I decided that video game menu themes might be a good one for a while since I'm kind of running out of TV shows. I was looking for the closing theme for Just the 10 of Us, but I can't find a copy where the ABC guy tells us what's coming up on 2020 later. It ruins the entire thing. So I thought, well, why don't I throw in Mike Tyson's punch out as Keithy, the voice from Greetings of Allentown, actually recommended that I do. So I had to keep my head watching these games because I'm in the Place to Be Nation chat on Facebook Messenger. I don't mean to sound like Bill Simmons or like, yeah, in the NFL ring of slack, I was saying blah, 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 Tom Brady is the greatest. Yeah, I don't mean to sound like that, but I was coming off very much the same as Bobby Heenan during the 1992 Royal Rumble, this is not the first time I've done this as a sports fan, believe me, during one of the sports highlights from the year 2000, which now that we've hit episode 100, going into the 2000s and going to keep rocking that up through episode 119. And eventually, I just needed to simmer down a little bit. But by the time the game nears the end of regulation, I'm just listening and watching TV theme songs on YouTube. And I'm paying attention to what's going on in the game, but I also like looking at the different versions of the One Day at a Time theme song, because that's one of the best ones, because it's got, like, the skyline of Indianapolis as they're, like, driving in there. It's like, that's not a city you ever really think of, Indianapolis. And plus, I'm a huge Valerie Bertinelli fan from back in the day. Oh, much as I do Zooey Deschanel today. But I'm not paying attention to this football game. They're converting third downs because all I'm doing is watching the One Day at a Time theme and, like, laughing at the antics of Schneider as they go through the all that. Mackenzie Phillips. I like the progression of how cracked out she is at various different seasons. I know that's not a nice thing to say, but it's 100% true. So I recommend that as something. If you need to calm down, just start watching TV themes on YouTube. It's very helpful. So, yes, the Patriots and the Rams in the Super Bowl on February 3rd. Gee, that sounds familiar. Wake up on Monday morning, and there's a line from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles that, from my experience, was actually true on this day.
I figure the temperature is 1.
And by the way, that's 1 Fahrenheit, not Celsius, because this is a Fahrenheit podcast, because it's the one true temperature measurement system that I will adopt. Help my mother clean stuff out of her basement as I'm going through looking for wrestling magazines in vain as once again I find stupid 1995 issues of Sports Illustrated and Time Magazine. Find my report cards from back in the day, like in fourth grade, where it goes for like every single one. A, like all the way down. And then you get to conduct and it's S minus. And for responsibility, S minus as well, but they gave me that I showed respect for others. They gave me an S for that. I didn't quite understand why I didn't get an S minus straight in all the conduct things. And I think that it was just because I wasn't a troublemaker for the sake of doing it. I was a bit of a litigator. I was like a lawyer kid or something like that. Thank God I didn't become a lawyer, because as I've said, I would have become a copyright lawyer and I would have just been completely miserable and I wouldn't be doing a podcast anyway. All right, back to the point of this whole thing for episode 100. My favorite Monday Night Raw ever, June 1st, 1998, Why is that my favorite one? Well, because a lot of consequential stuff happened. Maybe it's just built up in my mind, but also because I had a VHS tape of this that I watched a lot and that I pulled sound clips from a lot because I had just gotten a microphone for my computer at that time. So some of the segments I would incorporate into my computer noises, which honestly would make errors that would happen a little bit more easy to take when Vince McMahon is saying it in one of the all-time great promos that he ever had. This show is a confluence of so many things going on. The incredible star power of 1998 WWF. Yeah, as I said, Vince is, I don't want to say at his absolute best because it's very hard to identify when that might have been, but the whole Mr. McMahon character is still very fresh and new because unless you lived in Memphis and was exposed to the USWA thing from 1993, from all the way back then, this character is only a couple of months old. His issues where he is actually going at Austin, starting at the Royal Rumble, fittingly enough, with Mike Tyson having played the Mike Tyson's Punch-Out theme at the top. But really, the day after WrestleMania 14 is when that feud kicks off in earnest. Austin is such a badass at this point, and there is a tipping point for him at some point in 1998 because he reaches such stratospheric heights that eventually he does have to start trending downhill. I would probably put that at somewhere around the Survivor Series. The injuries eventually, of course, do catch up to him. But right here, he's coming off that magnificent over-the-edge match with Dude Love, Mick Foley. That would become the template for all Attitude Era matches from then on and would rarely, if ever, be matched. You have The Undertaker, who is still at a very high level. He's evolving, though, at this time, as that Kane feud is still going on, and they are actually going to match up on this episode of Raw. It is the main event, a number one contenders match, which, if you'll remember, the King of the Ring 1998, both Kane and The Undertaker would have big nights in that one. The continuing rise of The Rock as the ruler of the nation. He's going against DX, very popular in their own right, lifting Triple H to that next level, although that would be stunted later in the year by some injuries that he would have. Not so much for The Rock, but I actually liked both groups, both The Nation and DX. Well, I kind of sided with The Nation because of just The Rock's unbelievable charisma and the fact that the eyebrow thing would make me laugh. The fact that the way he would look at the fans when they were saying Rocky sucks and how he was conducting himself as a veteran. Now, it helps that he's a third-generation talent, but the fact that he recovered from where he was at a year before is incredible. As they're transitioning into this new Attitude Era, which you can really trace back to that speech from late 1997 where Vince, you know, the good guys and bad guys speech, you got people that are more emblematic of this coming era coming in, like Edge, my favorite version of Edge, the loner dude who has a vignette on this show, Val Venus, who had debuted a couple of weeks before. The gimmick, well, there are a few issues with the gimmick, but in his match, I'll explain why that gimmick could actually exist for that period of time. And then a reboot of the Godwins as Southern Justice, the keepers and protectors of Jeff Jarrett, at least in this one. This is, just thinking back to all the various times that I've watched wrestling, and I've started keeping track on when I've been doing the most shows, and it's been mostly 1989 and 1991, and I loved wrestling during that time, but when you're a kid, you don't quite have as much access to it because you don't have a job, you're reliant on, you know, your parents' money to order pay-per-views and all that stuff. 1998 was, I consider, the absolute peak of my fandom. Now, I don't know how that extends out to now, but I'm thinking more of pre-2014 anyway. I don't even know how I would really do it now because I watch so much different stuff now. so I see a greater diversity of things. But in that one calendar year, I went to three pay-per-views from three different wrestling promotions in a span of about 4.5-5 months. Gone to WrestleMania 14 at the Fleet Center in Boston, and then Slamboree 98 from WCW at the Worcester Centrum, and then randomly to ECW Heatwave 98 out in Dayton, Ohio in August. Going to Nitro, going to Raw, going to the ECW shows at the Wonderland Greyhound Park, all that sort of stuff. I was just so heavily invested in all three shows because WCW on this night, June 1st, 98, they actually did a Nitro from Washington, D.C. that if you watch it on the network, it is pretty damn good. It is the Chris Jericho conspiracy victim one where he's holding the sign outside the White House. And all that good stuff. I had mentioned a master plan earlier with regard to the snow. And I had this in my head because my wife, she does not care for wrestling. She's really just here to break down any weddings we might go to as part of the wedding wrap-up show. But I had this idea that I kind of want to go to WrestleMania because I can go because it's in New Jersey. I could get there in 3.5 hours if I drive really fast. So why the hell don't I just throw caution to the wind and do it? Question is, how do I break this to my wife? And I thought about it, and I saw that this storm was coming, and I said, fine, I go out and I move this snow all by myself while she sits inside and either watches TV or she was knitting something for her sister's baby shower. And that's great. I'm perfectly fine with that. That's the system we've had for years now. But I thought, how about when I come in, I'll just slip it in there. Oh, by the way, when I was out there moving the 7th inch of snow, I got the idea that maybe I kind of want to go to WrestleMania this year. And I slid that in there. And so I went ahead and booked a hotel for myself in northern New Jersey, fairly close to MetLife Stadium on Saturday and Sunday. It's refundable, so I could change it and stay somewhere else if I really want to, if I change my mind and want to stay in Manhattan. So, yeah, I do plan to attend WrestleMania. I don't have tickets. I mean, those are minor details for stuff like that. I like looking at stuff of like a lot of limited view seatings for that show. I'm not sure exactly how that stadium is going to look. I've been there for football and had really good seats. So I expect to be up in the heavens for this because I don't see a way where somebody that I'd be able to get the same deal I got for the football tickets. Also, looking at the ROH show at Madison Square Garden, simply because that looks like an interesting experience to go to a wrestling show in that building that is not WWF. And I want to see if I can scrounge up tickets for that one. So yeah, who knows? Maybe I will even run into a few listeners there. I don't have t-shirts or anything that would identify you as a listener to my show. So maybe what I should just do is wear my bright orange Cal Ripken Jr. jersey that I got for Christmas as like my identifier the entire time. Like, oh yeah, there's that guy who hosts that show where he talks about sports highlights for 30% of the show and then a little bit of wrestling here and there, and then the rest is about music and pop culture. That, yeah, maybe I'll do something like that. I don't know. There's a lot of time to kind of figure that out. So, without any further ado, before getting into the show, as I said, sports moments from the year 2000. And I really don't want to make these too provincial, but part of this whole thing in my podcasting philosophy is make it relatable. Make, you know, I don't want to make this like all like me telling my life story or anything. But there is a tie back to wrestling for this first one. So let's get to it, because this is a 2-hour Raw, and this show might run really long.
Swinging a high fly ball, right field deep, way back, it is gone! A 2-run homer for Trout Nixon, and the Red Sox lead it 2-0!
It would be impossible to make any Major League Baseball game played in the month of May bigger than that one was in the year 2000, the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend. Yet the Red Sox and Yankees tied, playing for first place on Sunday Night Baseball, ESPN. Oh, and Pedro Martinez at his absolute apex versus a still great Roger Clemens for the Yankees. And they duel for 8 innings. Nobody scores until finally Trot Nixon hits that home run off Roger Clemens. Which brings me to my story. For that weekend, I was visiting my girlfriend who lived near Allentown, Pennsylvania, fittingly enough. And I said something to her brother as Trot Nixon came to the plate, channeling once again my inner Bobby Heenan from the 1992 Royal Rumble, where I said, if Trot Nixon hits a home run here, I'll never do anything bad again. And he looked at me like, huh? And then when Nixon hit the home run, I thought to myself, well, you're the only one who heard that. So I think, good. And of course, the Yankees would end up winning the division with a horrible 87-74 record because the Red Sox did not exactly do a good job at the trade deadline. They missed their one chance to go over the Yankees during that turn of the century period. But hey, it's good to know that Trot Nixon always owned Roger Clemens for as long as they both shall live. Not quite to the extent of Mike Piazza, but then again, Trot Nixon never got beamed in the head by Clemens. By the way, I thought about including the Piazza-Clemens stuff, but that's been litigated so much with, you know, the throwing of the bat and Clemens clearly throwing at his head. It's just like, whatever. And speaking of guys who got hit in the head really, really hard, you got Vince McMahon from over the edge the night before. In the finish to that match, Dude Love goes to hit Austin in the head with a chair. Austin gets out of the way, and Vinnie Mac takes the chair shot to the head, knocking him cold. But this is very bizarre, this cold open to Monday Night Raw, where Vince is actually the voiceover guy describing the action of himself being rendered unconscious by the chair.
Last night's shallow victory by Stone Cold Steve Austin was overshadowed by concern for the condition of WWF owner Vince McMahon. Under the specter of The Undertaker, who stood guard at ringside, Steve Austin and Dude Love fought a brutal but yet a fair match. However, in one sheer act of incompetence, Dude Love nearly decapitated Vince McMahon. And as the valiant McMahon lay motionless, Austin covered Dude Love. And in one of the most selfish, heartless, and cruel acts in history, took McMahon's very own lifeless hand and counted himself to victory. Steve Austin won the match, but will forever be stained with the label of being the most undeserving and cold-hearted WWF champion of all time.
I don't know what to comment on more. The fact that Vince is such a control freak that he's doing the voiceover for his own angle, which, I don't know, there might be legitimate reasons for that. But also the referring to himself in the third person as he's doing it, where he's not saying I or me or anything like that. I'm indicting him on one count of imitating Ricky Henderson with all the third person stuff, but fine. So we go into the Rosemont Horizon. I would love to see a show there. Now, somebody from the Chicagoland area will probably inform me that that place is a complete dump. It's not as old as I thought it was. It was only built in 1980, I believe, to house DePaul University basketball, if I remember reading that correctly. And Mick Foley is sitting in a folding chair in the ring. He was Dude Love the night before, but here he is just good old Mick Foley. And I gotta say, this multi-character thing that Foley had was so incredible because it was an easy way to stay fresh. Ordinarily, you'd have to go away for a couple of months and then come back. But him, he could just transform and assume this other character. And it's basically like he left under the old character and is now in as this new guy where we can suspend disbelief and all that. He appears to have some sort of bruised cheekbone. And in that match, there was so much going on that he probably was legitimately injured. We're going to see Austin later. He's got some stitches in his forehead. Now, I assume Mick Foley, having suffered this injury, is vowing to take it easy in June of 1998. Maybe take some of the month off, something like that, you know, to try and heal up some of those injuries. No, of course not. So he's got something else to say.
Well, it was not a good night in Dudeville last night.
Yeah, to say the least.
I lost my teeth. I cracked my face. I lost my teeth. I lost the match. Hell, I might as well come riding out and admit it. Stone Cold Steve Austin kicked my ass last night.
He's been waiting in the ring 15 minutes to say that.
Good crowd out there tonight. Let's really try to win this one. Hey, boys.
That man traveled 15 hours by bus to say that.
I love that line from Slapshot so much, where he just parades through the locker room. And JR saying that reminded me of that. So that match, by any standard, I think, is a top 30 in WWF history. I know that maybe garbage matches might not be your thing, but it would be imitated so often as you would go forward trying to recapture the magic of it. And there was no way to do that because you have performers like Austin and Mick Foley. You have Vince as the referee, and this is the one where they had Gerald Briscoe as the timekeeper and Pat Patterson as the ring announcer, which was so great prior to the match with the over-the-top introductions of everybody, especially of Vince. It was so damn good. And with Patterson with his voice, you know, tripping over some words, that I think it made it even better. Over the Edge also had the great intro to the pay-per-view, which for whatever reason isn't on YouTube, but if you load up the Over the Edge pay-per-view on the award-winning WWE Network, you'll see it right off the top with all the Stalin-esque imagery, or like Orwellian and all that sort of stuff with the totalitarian state. I don't know if it was Stalin, actually. They might have just used Dan Severn for that. I'd have to double-check. Foley senses that he might need to make it up to Mr. McMahon in some way, so he calls him out to apologize to him. So Vince makes his way down to much jeering from the Chicago audience. No music for Vinnie Mac back then. No Chance in Hell is still a good 6 or 7 months away. And there's something, I don't know, oddly charming about him coming out to no music at all. As Vince goes into this, you can tell he's not exactly in the best mood for accepting an apology from somebody who hit him with a chair over the head. And this is by far my favorite Vince McMahon segment ever.
So I apologize for letting you down, and I'm going to come back at 100%.
You want me to accept your apology? You want me to accept an apology from someone who is a miserable failure as a superstar and a failure as a human being as well? You want me to accept your apology? Well then, let's begin by you getting down on your knees.
It is a little weird that Vince McMahon is asking somebody to get on their knees in front of him, almost like it wasn't the first time or the last time. That's not exactly something you do once, like kill a hooker. It's something that's really more of a way of life. And with that, Mick Foley then gave a blowjob to Vince McMahon to completion. Hey, I'm just kidding. It's just that the optics of it are a little strange, and Foley is confused by it because he says, "You are joking, right?" But Vince, oh, he's far from done here.
You're the joke. Get out on your knees! Wow.
I think we've got ourselves a little problem here, Vince. See, I came out here to apologize, but I want you to understand my kids are at home watching this show, and I will not allow you to embarrass me on national television.
You don't have to worry about that because you're already an embarrassment to me, an embarrassment to fans all over the world. You're an embarrassment to yourself, and I dare say you're also an embarrassment to your very own family. Get on your knees!
That was my error code on my computer in college, the line of, you're an embarrassment to yourself, and I dare say you're also an embarrassment to your very own family. There's so many Vince gems in just this one promo, but Foley, he kind of insinuates that maybe Vince had it coming with the chair thing the night before, and that it maybe felt good to do that. So, Mr. McMahon has a proposition for Mick Foley.
No, you got it wrong. You see, I didn't underestimate Stone Cold Steve Austin's abilities. I just overestimated yours, dude.
I've got a little confession to make, and that is, when I took that steel chair last night and wrapped it around your skull, deep inside, it felt pretty damn good.
Why don't you do it again? Why don't you do it right now? There's the chair. Come on. Come on. Make my day, dude. Come on. Come on. Hit me. Come on. Come on. Hit me with a chair. Come on. Blast me. And just think about that college education. That college fund you've got for your kids going poof, right up in the air. Come on, dude. Come on, hit me. Come on, what about that new house you just moved into? Huh? What about it? You know the one, the 20-year mortgage? 20 years! Hit me. Come on, hit me with the chair. What about that little fund you got set aside? For your parents, you know the one. You'll go through that in no time at all. Come on, dude. Come on, dude. Hit me. Dude. Come on. Have some guts for once in your life. Come on. Hit me with the bloody chair. Come on.
Wow, that is so amazing. And congratulations to Foley on paying off that 20-year mortgage last year. I'm assuming that that is what happened. But I'm also concerned, what happened to that college fund for Noel and Dewey? Did that ever get used? Because I'm pretty sure Noel did not go to college. And I'm not sure about Dewey, but he's on the writing staff now. I don't think you really need a college degree for that. Love his use of bloody chair. You know, reaching out to those foreign markets where bloody would be used as an adjective. Because Vince, this is his product. So he's got everything in mind. So next, he explains the question that you'd sometimes ask. If he hates Austin so much in this storyline, why doesn't he just fire him?
Let me tell you something. The only reason I haven't fired Stone Cold Steve Austin is because he makes me richer. You know what you make me, dude? All you do is make me sick.
There's another error message from my computer from back in the day. All you do is make me sick. And that is a good explanation for why Austin isn't just fired, although it probably plants a seed in somebody who's really thinking about it, like, if I buy that Austin t-shirt, I'm just making this Mr. McMahon guy richer. So I guess for somebody who's really buying into the whole thing. But okay, let's set that aside. It's time for the grand finale, and Mr. McMahon has fired people on the show many, many times since 1998. But to me, I don't care what he does, this one is just never going to be topped because of the way he caps it off.
So I'll tell you what. Your services here in the World Wrestling Federation are no longer required.
What? Mr. McMahon firing Mick Foley? For not getting the job done last night? This be the last time we hear this song in the World Wrestling Federation? Well, that's not going to break my heart, but not seeing Mick Foley compete would certainly be a disappointment. And oh, look at him. He's Dick Clark again. He's taunting poor Mick Foley.
Back in the day, I did an edit so that the sign-off message on my computer was him saying, "Your services are no longer required." I edited out the World Wrestling Federation one because it didn't really make sense if anybody else was listening. But as this segment just builds up to the end and he fires him, and you get that Dude Love music playing, which is always enjoyable. I mean, it's, you know, cheesy and all that, but it's perfectly fine. And Vince, this is his chance to start dancing in the ring. He's laughed and guffawed at the likes of Uncle Elmer and Cousin Junior. Now, with Vince dancing to that music, that might be enough, but to me, it's enhanced by what JR said.
Oh, look at him. He's Dick Clark again.
Anytime now that I dance at a wedding, all I can think of is that I'm being Dick Clark again. But this makes me think of a world where Vince McMahon is the host of American Bandstand instead of Dick Clark. I think it would be a completely different show, given Vince's preference for black people dancing. So really, in the world where Vince McMahon is hosting American Bandstand instead of Dick Clark, the show would basically be Soul Train. I don't know why I think of that, but oh my God, what a segment. This two great performers at or near their peaks. Vince McMahon just cracking me up with line after line after line. I know it's commonplace to have Raw start these days with an extended talk segment, but it's really enhanced when you have people of the ability of Mick Foley and Vince McMahon, and it's not Baron Corbin droning on and on for 12 consecutive minutes.
Christie kicks it high and short. Going to be fielded by Lorenzo Neal at the 25.
Yeah,
pitches it back to Wycheck. He throws it across the field to Dyson.
He's got something.
30,
he's 40, got something.
50,
he's got
40.
It. He's got it.
As someone who drives around and runs errands on NFL Sundays a lot and listens to various local commentators on the radio, if there's one friggin' thing that I can't stand, it's when color guys shout over the play-by-play guy when he's trying to make the damn call. Let him call the friggin' play and then do your announcements. Save your cheerleading, okay? Hit the damn cough button, all right? Nobody wants to hear you yell, "Yes, or, he's got it, he's got it." Dick, this is how you make a call right here.
Probably the final play of the game in regulation. It is caught by Dyson. Can he get in? No, he cannot. Mike Jones made the tackle. And the Rams have won the Super Bowl.
Couple things. Mike Jones, that is not Virgil. That is a completely different Mike Jones and presumably no relation. And secondly, I hope to not hear those words in a week and a half. The Rams have won the Super Bowl. That game also was in Atlanta, and that was the infamous Ray Lewis Super Bowl. So nobody hang out with Ray Lewis this week down in Atlanta, because that bad things tend to happen when you do that. So our commentators for Hour 1, which is dubbed Raw is War for ratings book purposes, because it's split into Raw is War and the War Zone in the second hour, where they would have more adult-oriented stuff. Jim Ross and Michael Cole as your color commentator. We will not see Jerry Lawler until Hour number 2. They tell us some King of the Ring qualifying matches coming up on this show. Three members of DX facing three members of the Nation in an elimination match coming up later, which is a rematch of the night before when a similar thing had happened at the Over the Edge pay-per-view. But first, we have LOD 2000, which is Hawk, Animal, and Draws, with Sonny there as well, taking on the Disciples of Apocalypse in a Chicago street fight, or a Rosemont street fight, to be more accurate. They are at the loading dock of the arena, and my fellow co-star of the Place to Be Nation Christmas special, Kevin Kelly, is there with Darren Drozdoff, or Droz, also known as Puke. And he knows from studying Godwin's Law, that's Godwin's with two N's at the end. Yeah, that has to do with hillbillies, but I guess the greater idea is to just make Vince McMahon laugh, and even if it's disgusting, that's going to work.
Draws, listen, I know you've been in some street fights before, but probably none of this magnitude.
Well, Kevin, I've been quite a few in my day. It's tasty, bro. I'm just looking forward to this one. You know, whenever they want to do, we'll do it. I'm looking forward to it, baby.
Well, certainly I know the presence of Hawk and Animal. I mean,
man, that's gonna stink right there. It's on your shoes. He puked on your shoes.
Yeah, thanks for that, Animal. We don't need the third grade book report accounting of it that you usually give to us. And yeah, Sunny is still with LOD 2000. She rolled in with them at WrestleMania 14, so it's been a couple of months. But Sunny's going to cycle out soon because this was also kind of an odd fit. Not quite as odd as the outfit she was wearing, which the top, if you were looking at her from a sky cam, you could pretty much see all the way down, I think, because it was not up against her skin. But she says something to try and justify her existence there.
You know what?
What a rush!
I would have played a fart sound, but I'm far too respectful to do something like that. This is more or less just an extended garbage match for about 3 or 4 minutes. Pretty even all the way through between DOA and LOD 2000. Eventually, you see a figure at the top of the ramp because it's being shot from the bottom of the ramp. There is one where a cart comes flying at the cameraman and he has to keep walking backwards to kind of stay out of the way of it. That was actually kind of funny. But you see this figure and he starts making his way down as I thank God that Tony Schiavone isn't calling this because there was a lot of trash barrel shots and Tony would say, well, those don't hurt like he did that one time. The last two standing are actually Puke, Drozdov, and Chains for the DOA. Chains, I had forgotten, became the leader of the DOA when Bryan Adams' crush had departed for WCW. The person who comes walking down the ramp, of all people, is The Undertaker, pretty much in regular clothing, and he sends Chains into the wall. This is actually when the cart comes flying down the ramp at the camera guy. The Undertaker looking not like himself for a guy who is very much that character. Just highly unusual. He beats up Draws, and then he starts yelling for Vince McMahon. So, time to stand by and wait and see what we have for that one. As you could probably gather by listening to the very end there, and you hear his theme start to play. We got Val Venus taking on Papi Chulo in a rather interesting matchup where you have the guy with the porn star gimmick taking on a guy whose name translated is Pimp Daddy, who would go on to become S.A. Rios later on, and whose biggest contribution would probably be introducing Lita to the WWF audience. Val, of course, is portrayed by Sean Morley, who would be Chief Morley years later when they would drop this whole gimmick because of the various issues that it would cause. And he had had some success in Mexico in the previous years under the name of Steel, which is funny because he probably could have kept that same name, Steel, except for the fact that if you're having him as a porn star, it would conflict with Lexington Steel, an existing porn star. By the way, I remember my friend Mike saying, you know why he called himself Lexington Steel, right? And this, we were walking around New York City. I'm like, no, I don't know. Why? He said, because his dick was longer than Lexington Avenue, which I thought was very funny. So Val's gimmick as a porn star, there are questions that you need to ask about this with it now 21 years in the rear view. Why could this take place? Obviously, they're embarking on this era of attitude, so to speak. But why a porn star? And how could this be allowed by a USA network that, while they didn't have complete say over what they were doing, you know, they could whisper things, say, maybe you don't want to do that. Kind of like, you know, how Friar Ferguson lasted one time out there, but this porn star character is built up after WrestleMania 14. And I'm convinced that the reason why it could happen in 1998 alone is because you had a situation in this country where the president was about to be impeached for basically getting a blowjob from an intern, although there are a whole lot of other things there. So you had all that out there every single day. And also, with the advent of the internet and all that, it was becoming more a part of the popular culture. But saying that, I don't think you could get away with that a couple of years later. And that goes to the other question of this, is the harm that this would cause in the long term, this one single gimmick. Yeah, you could sell merch, but some of the Val Venus merch is some of the stupidest stuff ever, where it's basically... I don't even want to get into all of it. You can use your imagination for what that would be. The harm it might cause with advertisers in the long term who say, why should we go into business with this company that had a character who was a porn star, and with all the innuendo, see, wrestling podcasts can actually use that term correctly, that they would do with Val, like the, you know, the wiener in the hot dog bun on the screen, the drilling, stuff like that. So while it was fun at the time and in the moment, and some of the things that he was doing was quite humorous, the damage long term, there's a Pandora's box that they opened with this thing that they could not undo. It was the proverbial can of worms. When basically he's just doing a more over-the-top version of the Rick Rude gimmick from years before, because Val Venus is actually brought in as a heel. The most obvious similarity with him and Rude comes down to the pre-match speech that he would always give.
Hello, ladies! No! I'm not happy to see ya. That is a gun in my pocket. Oh. And believe you me, this gun shoots no blanks. Oh.
Now that's classy. It comes in as a heel because they assume that the audience would react to him in the same way that they did Rick Rude earlier on in the decade, but things had changed a great deal since 1990 when you last saw Rick Rude as an in-ring competitor, not the one who was there as part of DX. And what's funny is this ends up being a reverse of the Honky Tonk Man situation, where he's getting cheered when they were expecting him to be booed. Honky came in, was booed when they were expecting him to be cheered. They show a woman in the crowd laughing when Val said, I have a gun in my pocket, which goes into the whole, girls are kind of gross when they talk about that sort of stuff. I think anybody, any woman would really cop to that. So Val jumps Poppy Chulo off the top, which is a very heel move. And the camel clutch that he locks in at one point, it's really like, it's actually kind of more the Rick Rude reverse chin lock lazy thing that he was doing back in like 1988. But he grinds on him to kind of add an element. But the thing about Sean Morley, even when he's in this gimmick as the porn star, he's still a very good wrestler on offense. Vertical suplex, follows up with a clothesline. I like what he does in there. He catches Poppy doing a crossbody and just slams him down. This is where Michael Cole points out that it's a fitting matchup with Pimp Daddy versus the porn star. Chulo does fight back, gets caught with a clothesline, a spinning heel kick and a drop kick, and finally a reverse of an Irish whip goes for the crucifix, does Poppy Chulo, but is caught with the Samoan drop, which, you know, is the proper counter for that particular move. The money shot finishes, which I guess is better than calling it a big splash, so to speak, but it is a good-looking move, the way he does it. I mean, I don't want to say he's going to get the same reaction to it that Jimmy Snuka was in 1982 and 83, but for 1998, that's a pretty good-looking finish. I talk about my time-traveling wrestlers quite a bit, and I'd like to have a feud with 1998 Val Venus taking on 1989 Rick Rude. I think that that would be pretty damn good, except for the fact that I don't think you could take Val Venus out of the years 1998 through 2000 and take him to any other time in wrestling history, because it just wouldn't have worked. I mean, he is truly, I think, maybe more than anybody else that I can think of, a product of a specific era that with that one gimmick.
Oh, McSorley slapped Brashear and caught him in the helmet.
The longest suspension belongs to Marty McSorley, who was handed a 23-game suspension for using his stick to whack the Canucks' Donald Brashear on the head back in February of 2000. Later that year, McSorley was found guilty in a British Columbia court for assault with a weapon.
Weird stuff always happening with my Boston Bruins up in Vancouver. Back in 1982, their star forward, Norman Levier, had a stroke that kind of arose from a hit that he received in the game. You got this incident in February of 2000, where Marty McSorley slashes Donald Brashear in the head. And then, of course, the Bruins would win the Stanley Cup in Vancouver in 2011, triggering some riots. So this incident in February of 2000, what had happened was Donald Brashear, earlier in the game, he had fought McSorley to answer for the fact that Brashear had crashed into Bruins goaltender Byron Defoe and ended his season with an injury, something that I'm still pissed about from last Saturday's Bruins game against the Rangers when a Ranger player ran into Rask. Oh, supposedly he might have been pushed. Whatever. I'll hear none of it. So McSorley wanted a rematch after he was beaten in the fight by Brashear. And McSorley was just totally washed up. I don't even know why he was on this particularly bad Bruins team that only won 24 games the entire season. Of course, they had 19 ties, so it does make it sound better than it actually was. 10 seconds left in the game. Brashear, as is his right, doesn't want to fight, so he gets clubbed on the side of the head. But the real damage was when he hit the ice. His helmet kind of fell off, and then his neck snapped back, and he hit the back of his head on the ice, which is where I think most of the damage was done. Now, did I see this live as it was happening? No. And it's not because... Well, something really weird happened to me that night that would never happen to any other college student in this day and age, because I was cleaning my room that night, which was also a pretty rare occurrence. And as I bent down to pick something up off the floor, I did not realize that my TV antenna rabbit ears were also on the floor. And as I bent down, I hit my eye right on the antenna, which is, you know, kind of ironic given what happened in the hockey game. And I had pretty blurry vision for a good week afterwards. I had to go to Mass Eye and Ear Infirmary and just get it checked out that I didn't do any sort of permanent damage. But I had to wear sunglasses for a week, which, you know, I didn't really do on a regular basis back then. So even if I wanted to see that incident happen, it was an 8-2 win for Vancouver, some ridiculous blowout, I wouldn't have been able to anyway because my vision was blurred. And we go from that to something that is more blurring the lines of reality and storyline. Because when Val Venis goes to the back after his match, he strangely doesn't go up the ramp. Instead, he kind of goes between the ramp and the crowd, and then through that same little passageway, I don't understand what the deal was, is The Undertaker, who's in his George Costanza outfit, where I don't know if it's sweatpants, but with the plain black shirt. Very, very strange seeing him like this. This dude is never out of character, and all of a sudden now he's out here to give us a new segment, Story Time with Mr. Calloway, because this does not resemble The Undertaker that we know.
Let's start from the beginning. Some 10 years ago, when I first arrived in the World Wrestling Federation, Vince McMahon was known for somebody that would give somebody an opportunity, even if they were just a little different. And Vince McMahon did just that. He gave me the chance to be myself, to be The Undertaker. But you see, that's where all the giving stopped and all the taking began. Shortly after my arrival here in the World Wrestling Federation, I became the Slayer of the Dragons. Now you ask, what do I mean by that?
That whole be myself, be the Undertaker thing is rather interesting when you look back with the benefit of hindsight again, that this is really the genesis of the American Badass biker gimmick, which is effectively what he wanted to be once he got tired of doing the Undertaker thing as we knew it. the Slayer of Dragons, by the way, you never even had a match with Ricky Steamboat. He left the company right of the job to you at that 91 TV taping. Are you still sore about that? But no, what he means is the feuds that he would have with the likes of Kamala, King Kong Bundy, Giant Gonzalez. All the giants and the freaks would be fed to The Undertaker, and he was not a guy who was regularly in the title picture. He got it a year after he debuted at the 91 Survivor Series, but that was only a six-day reign. Occasional title shots, when you think of it. Royal Rumble 1996 comes to mind, but it was few and far between for a guy on his level.
And after I made his kingdom safe, and there was no one left, well, then I got my opportunities. Oh, yes, I am a two-time former World Wrestling Federation champion. But as you all know, my tenure as champion, they didn't last very long. Why? Because Vince McMahon didn't want someone like The Undertaker representing the World Wrestling Federation.
All right, it's kayfabe hat time to really examine those two title reigns. The first one is 6 days between the Survivor Series in 91 to the This Tuesday in Texas pay-per-view. And yes, that does not last very long by any standard. However, you're setting him up for bigger things. You established that he beat Hulk Hogan, and that's fine. And you're putting up the world title in the Royal Rumble match, in which he's given a preferential draw from 20 to 30. Now, granted, he only got number 20, so he got the worst possible number he could have gotten. But still, he's definitely part of the picture, and it was at that point he was going through some changes in his life. He was seeing things differently, you know, preventing Jake Roberts from nailing Savage and or Elizabeth with a chair on Saturday Night's Main Event. So he had a change in priorities that I don't think he's bringing up. His second title reign started at WrestleMania 13, March of 97, so only a little more than a year before this. And he held the title for about 4.5 months up through the beginning of August, so from WrestleMania to SummerSlam. I would not say that that's an insignificant period of time relative to other reigns from the time period. I'd say that that's roughly about average. And when you compare it to earlier in 1997, when it was going around like a hot potato, I think that he's kind of off base in saying that it didn't last very long.
Even after all his hand-chosen favorites left town for greener pastures, more money, I stayed here. I stayed by his side, thinking my time would come. How do I get repaid for that? He forces me to fight my own brother. He gives Paul Bearer an open forum to discuss every tragic incident that ever happened in the life of The Undertaker. For what reason? Let me tell you why. Because it's all ratings.
I don't know why I'm laughing at the... He gave Paul Bearer a form to talk about every tragic life that happened. Every tragic thing that happened in the life of The Undertaker. It just strikes me as funny. So here's this guy who never breaks this uber-serious character that he has. And now he's coming out and complaining about shit and blaming it on the quest for TV ratings. This is just beyond the pale bizarre. What's going on here? Because think about what he was before, and now all of a sudden you have this suddenly on a Monday night.
And even after all that, I never lost my smile.
And that kind of sounds like shots fired, except for the fact that Shawn Michaels isn't really there. He doesn't make his return until a couple of months later as sort of that weird commissioner character who would float in and out. But the word is that The Undertaker, the man, the guy backstage, didn't really care for Shawn Michaels' douchebag act that he had had for much of the 1990s. So if he's going to take a shot about losing your smile, might as well do it here, because I don't think this entire thing is scripted.
I demand my shot at the World Wrestling Federation title.
That's seriously the longest that anybody has taken to ask for a title shot, because that went on for over 5 minutes with the whole bizarre story of his complaints, of his family tragedy, and all that. But that brings Vince McMahon out. And as he comes out, JR and Cole are talking about The Undertaker's role at the Over the Edge, just kind of standing guard at ringside, watching. I don't want to say he's watching Austin's back, but to make sure that there are no shenanigans with all the odds stacked against Austin. And this included one of the all-time great Undertaker's choke slams, or choke slam by anybody, when he put Pat Patterson through the table at ringside. So Vince hits the ring, and now he's dealing with yet another disgruntled employee. And he's still as angry as he was earlier, despite his fun dancing demeanor.
I'm going to give you the answer you're looking for in just a minute. But first, you're going to hear me out. After all I've done for you, you chokeslammed me damn near to hell last week. Giant vulture last night. And why? To get my attention? You got it. You got it. You want to talk about loyalty, dedication, honor, all those qualities you have? I'll grant you that. And I'm appreciative for it. But you know, let's face it, what have you done for Vince McMahon lately?
I think, what have you done for Vince McMahon lately, which was also a message that I put on my computer, I think that should replace the then, now, and forever thing that you see at the beginning of WWE shows on the network.
As far as your family's concerned, all your family problems, I got a question for you. Is Paul Bearer telling the truth when he says that your mother was a whore?
Oh.
Wait a minute. I've got your answer.
Oh, no. My God.
You want the answer?
What has got
you? You want the answer? You want to be the number one contender. You deserve to be the number one contender. That's what you want? That's what you'll get. Sure. No problem. You'll get it. You'll get it. If you defeat your opponent in this ring tonight. There you go. You got what you wanted, okay? So whoever wins the match between you and your opponent will be the number one contender in this ring live tonight. So let's see what happens, Undertaker. Let's see what happens when you have to face your brother, Kane!
Sometimes in business, an effective boss has to get his employees to do things that they don't necessarily want to do or are not comfortable doing in order to get the job done. So it's hilarious. After all that, all the kvetching by The Undertaker about being forced to fight his family and to air all his dirty laundry and put it out on the line, that I'll give you what you want, but you have to fight your brother one more time. Just one more time. The very thing that he complained about. And this all feeds into the Michael Quinn of the Our Vantage Point podcast theory that it was always about the title for The Undertaker. It's just that other stuff would get in the way. Like taking down any giant that came across the block. Sort of like what Andre had back in the day, where Andre the Giant isn't challenging whoever is champion. He's not in there against Bob Backlund. I don't think he had any title matches against superstar Billy Graham in that 1 year. But you kept him separate from all of that, and they were kind of doing that with The Undertaker, but in a more organic fashion. Yeah, he got the shot against Bret at the 96 Rumble, but outside of that, he's mostly kept away from that because he's operating in a second sort of non-title division of the big man title. That is sort of its own category, but he's also a small enough guy at 320 to want to be the world champion. He's not freakishly big like Andre was. So he's sort of in that middle ground where he has this internal conflict within, where do I want to be the big guy champion or do I want to be the champion champion? And why can't I be both? Very fascinating times for The Undertaker in the middle of 1998. Having these weird discussions about The Undertaker is a strange job, but somebody's got to do it. And you can go to ProWrestlingOnly.com to explore other podcasts, match reviews, features and retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books, video games, matches, playlists, wrestler appearances and non-wrestling TV shows, and more. You can join the conversation by signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums, online for over a decade, with over 2,000 registered members and an archive of a lot of threads. I don't have a number for this week. It's still updating on the scoreboard. The message board is a vibrant community, whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive, like, oh, I don't know, Undertaker versus Bret Hart at Royal Rumble 96, take a deep dive in the Microscope forum, or discuss more topics from wrestling's past and present. Check all of that out and more at ProWrestlingOnly.com.
All right, move about, Sabre. Good, good, good. Really nice. Yeah, show me a little more profile. Smile. Yeah. All right, excellent. A little more motion. Movement, movement. I love movement. Excellent, excellent. Oh, that's wonderful. Yes. Yeah. And it's right in the open.
Busy camera boy, the CPS 1000 with its constant pressure system, it's the revolutionary water delivery system. How's that?
How's that? Get
Super Soaker, the pressure is on.
It all struck me as kind of strange because you're selling the Super Soakers to kids, most likely, under 16, but yet you're using the Let's Get Ready to Suck It crew of DX. And you also got Sable in there, and technically she's now out of the WWF from what happened at Over the Edge. More on that in just a minute. But DX actually crossing with Sable is interesting too, although there's no Triple H there, probably because you don't want to remind people that him and Sable were together at WrestleMania 12. Bring that whole thing up again. And then having the camera guy explain the specs of the gun, just really strange. I feel like it was a perfect opportunity for Billy Gunn to actually tell us what was in the Super Soaker gun. Kind of surprised the Super Soaker people didn't really try to take advantage of this publicity with DX and come out with the Super Soaker Billy Gunn gun. Do something like that. Anyway, that might have been a bridge too far. So for our next match, a King of the Ring qualifier, we get Steve Blackman taking on Marvelous Mark Mero. Now, you had the angle with Sable, and they recapped this quote-unquote match from Over the Edge, where if Sable beat Mark Mero, she would win her freedom, and if Mero won, Sable would have to leave the WWF forever. It was one of the last examples of Mark Mero getting one over on somebody, where he finally appears to show sympathy for Sable and agrees to be pinned to just kind of put this thing to bed, give her her freedom. Of course, she would have gotten freedom either way, because if she's out of the WWF, she's free from him. And if she stays, you know, she's not with him. That was the whole point of the match. It's a very strange concept. So he lays down, she goes down for the cover, and he rolls her up into a small package, picks up the win, and celebrates like he just won the World Series or something like that. And Sable walks off all dejected, which kind of a daring thing considering how big Sable was. Oh, she's leaving the WWF. I'm not sure how people without access to the internet in 1999 might have reacted to that whole storyline, although the ratings for June 1st, 1998 with Raw and Nitro both live on this night, Raw prevailed 4.4 to 3.7, so they're starting to widen out a bit. And I do think that the NBA playoffs kind of interrupting Nitro in the month of May hurt them a little bit in that year. Not that much, and it certainly, I think, was inevitable that the WWF was going to pass them, but I do think that that was less than helpful. So he doesn't have Sable anymore, and Mero doesn't want to come to the ring by himself, apparently. So he is going to introduce his new valet.
Oh,
However, the lady I'm about to introduce is everything that Sable is not. Not only does she know her place, not only does she have a bond to die for, but she's black, she's beautiful, and she's mine. Ladies and gentlemen, the sensuous, the sultry Jacqueline!
Wow.
Wow, indeed. Yes, I'm a fan. Hair to her ass. Basically, the whole look. You can say this for Mark Mero. He was certainly the best at getting women over who aren't necessarily in-ring competitors, but having a valet and getting them over, Mero's certainly the best at that. So the match starts right hands, and Blackman answers with the educated feet, but Mero bails to the outside, comes back in. Blackman keeps control, though, with a backbreaker. And I mentioned this many episodes ago, that Steve Blackman is like a supercharged Jerry Flynn. And the difference between those two guys is emblematic of the difference between the WWF and WCW. You both have these relatively bland dudes who do martial arts stuff. WCW does Jerry Flynn. They develop no real character around him. Whereas in WWF, they give Steve Blackman this character of, yeah, he does martial arts. He's also this no-nonsense sort of tough guy who's not going to win the world title, but, you know, you respect him in the ring. Vertical snap suplex, front kick, and a cover, but Jacqueline actually she either put the foot on the ropes or she was shouting out to the referee to make sure he saw it, which is just good managing, in my opinion. That's not cheating. And she gets up on the apron, and Mero from behind with the China Memorial low blow uppercut, and immediately gets Blackman in position. Looks like he's going to go for the TKO finisher, which, no, he doesn't do it anymore. Instead, he does a Samoan drop because Sable's not around, which means he's not going to do the TKO because that's what turns Sable on. What you don't understand is that Sable loves guys who do finishing moves from a fireman's carry position and then spins them to the mat in some form or fashion. It can be a TKO or an F5. I don't know why I'm talking like Vince Russo, because he had nothing to do with any of this shit, quite frankly. The Samoan drop, which Cole screws up and calls it TKO before JR corrects him. Mero goes up to the top rope for the shooting star press. And this is something of a new start for Marvelous Mike Mero. Not anus tart, like in Arrested Development. A new start for him with Jacqueline, going back to the old shooting star press that he was doing when he was the wild man Mark Mero. So you think, well, things are looking up for him. Got the hot new manager. No, he'd be gone by the end of the year. And his name, for whatever reason, I've explored this in past episodes, it just pisses people off. I don't know if it was his opinion on the Benoit thing, or if he was a pain in the ass or something. I mean, I don't think he was a bad guy. I've never heard anything of the sort. But it really is amazing how it didn't work for him at all, hardly, in the WWF, considering that they definitely wanted him. They wanted to bring him in. Probably hoped that they could have used the Johnny B. Bad gimmick. But he ends up as a rare example of a guy who was handled way better in WCW than he was in the WWF.
Everybody who says Stone Cold, it means tough. It means absolutely tough, and we think you are amazing.
You're Stone Cold. You rock, man.
Oh, hell yeah.
You are the biggest icon.
It was one of the greatest pay-per-view events I've ever seen, if not the greatest.
Hell, I'm going to keep raising hell as long as I can. Hold on, I think we got a call coming in from Motel 6. I think it's Vince.
Okay, hang on. Do we have him, finally?
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, the owner of the WWF.
Thank you very much, yeah.
Good morning, Vince. You sorry, man. Now, I'm thinking about coming out with my own national holiday, Punch Your Boss in the Mouth Day.
How frustrating is Stone Cold Steve Austin for you?
He's an embarrassment. He's very frustrating. Austin's had it, and it starts tonight.
Because, if you know, if you be off enough tonight, I'm going to wrap another steel chair around your little head.
Right?
Did you get a chance to see how you actually counted 1, 2, 3 last night?
You remember that, Vince? How many stars did you see last night when Dude Love cracked that damn chair over your head? You called it right down the middle. He gave me the big 3 count. Big championship, slow, deliberate, right there in the middle. 1, 2, 3. Stone Cold, still your World Wrestling Federation champion. Give me a hell yeah, Vince.
Hell yeah!
Earlier that day, Austin was on the Mancow Morning Madhouse show in Chicago that was also, I think, nationally syndicated. I always thought that was kind of a stupid name for a show. I mean, the guy's name is Mancow, I guess. But then again, my radio show on WTBU, Boston University Student Radio, was called Manic Pete's Midnight Madhouse. So who the hell am I to talk about naming shows? So I guess I must have gotten it in my head or whatever. So Austin's in studio. They have Vince call in, and they do their repartee between the two of them. And it's just fantastic. We got more of that coming up, because Austin and Vince will be on commentary for the Undertaker versus Kane match.
I am both. I am everything. I am nothing. I am everywhere. I'm invisible. I'm in your head and won't let go. You yearn for my approval. My forgiveness, my glance. I look away. I am light, but you will never see me.
Oh my God, I love these Edge vignettes so much. Loner Dude Early Edge is my favorite one, because he's very Raven-esque, but there's a definite delineation between him and Raven. It would not be something that would be considered a ripoff. He reminds me of freaking Batman in these things where he kind of hits that guy for no reason at one point. But my favorite part of this particular vignette, and it's, they're all on YouTube, and there's one of them where it shows up about a minute 33 in, and this is the one that aired on this Raw and what I pulled from, where about 5 seconds into it, there's a nice shot of him kissing a character who looks very much like Lita.
A chilling vision of things to come.
Well, you know, whatever makes Edge happy is fine with me. You know what makes me happy as we enter hour number two in the war zone on Monday Night Raw is DX versus Nation 6-man tag matches. Because when you break it down with all the people involved, they are all either peaking, ascendant. No, nobody is tired of any of these people. You look back at somebody like Road Dogg or Billy Gunn, and it's easy to be like, ugh. But back then, in the moment, these guys were actually ascendant. Now, I mean, I wasn't looking at Billy Gunn and saying, boy, I hope he wins King of the Ring next year, or I hope he turns up in New Japan 2 decades from now. I wasn't thinking anything like that. But they had a 6-man match the night before at Over the Edge, which was a different combination than what we have here. It was Owen, Kama, and D'Lo taking on the New Age Outlaws in Triple H. And the finish was Owen Hart beating Triple H with the pedigree. Now, who says that Paul doesn't put anybody over? He's going to point directly to that in spite of the fact that he won all the bigger matches. And nobody really remembers this one from it was a non-Big Four show. Semi-main event right before Austin Dude Love. So once that happens, you kind of forget about the match that happened before. This one is actually an elimination match, and it's going to be Triple H and the New Age Outlaws taking on The Rock, Owen Hart, and D'Lo Brown. So this is like the all-star team, I think, of both sides, with all due respect to X-Pac, because he had just come back in. And he may have been nursing an injury of some kind. One thing I do like about the Triple H, are you ready speech, is that while it is crude, it is a pretty perfect satire of what Michael Buffer was doing over on the WCW show. I mean, let's get ready to suck it. Obviously, you can't say it today, but it's like, okay, Triple H finally, after all this time, gets himself super over saying something that the talent these days, for which he is responsible, would never in a million years be allowed to say. If flip over to the Nation side of things, The Rock is just so awesome at this point. All he has to do is turn his head a certain way, lift an eyebrow. People are still chanting Rocky sucks with great fervor, because that changeover really doesn't happen until that MSG crowd at SummerSlam just experienced the magic of that ladder match with The Rock and Triple H. Owen Hart is there too, And you look at him, and he's in the street sign, and all you could think of is the Jason Sensation parody. Boy, talk about a guy who really kind of went off the rails, Jason Sensation. And a lot of questions get asked, like, why did Owen Hart end up in The Nation? Doesn't that seem a little weird why he's there? People leave it maybe sometimes unspoken about the racial aspect of it. Well, one thing I can point to is he's one hell of a mentor for the young guys in The Nation. So if they're hanging out together and working together, he can mentor The Rock, D'Lo Brown, Mark Henry, also a guy that would have needed that kind of guidance. But it's an obvious answer to why he's there. It's because he's the Blackheart, damn it. So of course he's going to join The Nation. He needed to find a group to belong to because none of his family is there anymore. What's he supposed to do? Join the DOA and go march on Charlottesville with the Harris brothers? Come on, give me a break. This is the only sensible thing that he could have done. Sergeant Slaughter, the commissioner, comes down to ringside to remove all the extra people. Mark Henry, China, X-Pac. Jim Ross compared it to the NBA's preventive officiating, which I think was coming in around that point. You had some high-profile brawls in the NBA. I forget what year it was where the Heat and the Knicks had that brawl. I think in the playoffs where Jeff Van Gundy was grabbing onto that dude's leg to try and keep him from doing any more damage. As they show China and X-Pac heading towards the back by themselves, I'm thinking, oh, I wonder what they're going to be doing alone together in the back. Start with D'Lo Brown and Triple H. Trips controls early and crotch chops at Rocky, which draws his ire. But D'Lo gets an edge, but is then whipped to the corner, and Triple H with a high knee out of the corner. Not the booty man high knee, but the Triple H knee-based offense. Tags in the Road Dog, and he's quickly met with an Arn Anderson spine buster by D'Lo Brown, which I rank 5.5 Arns out of 10. Pretty good, but what it needs is more people in the background jumping up and down with a fist in the air, because that's the thing that Arn Anderson could always bring out. Dog does tag his partner, Billy Gunn, reversal of an Irish whip, which, by the way, so commonplace in these late 90s matches. Everything is off an Irish whip. It's so hilarious. When D'Lo hits the ropes, he's met with a knee in the back by the Road Dog, the Bret Hart Memorial transition move.
He's not fucking dead.
Sorry, while technically true, for the purposes of 1998 WWF, Bret Hart pretty much is dead. Pile driver by Billy Gunn eliminates D'Lo, so we're doing that thing where the Survivor Series match sees these really quick eliminations. In a six-man elimination on TV, you're probably not going to get enough time. These days, they might get a little bit more, but in 1998, where no match is lasting longer than 10 minutes on television, it is tough. But you can sacrifice D'Lo because his big push isn't going to happen for a couple of months, I don't think. The Rock is in, so we get a sneak preview of the SummerSlam 99 matchup with The Rock and Billy Gunn. Gunn tags out to Road Dogg. They cut off the ring really briefly, but a short clothesline by The Rock. Road Dogg fights back with right hands, and he charges, and he is caught with the Rock Bottom, and that's a quick three count on the Road Dogg, even by the standards of 1998. So Billy Gunn is back in, as we're now at 2-2. Commentary makes reference to the Rock versus Farouk match for the Intercontinental title the night before, which may get forgotten a little bit with the crazy main event at Over the Edge, because on the pay-per-view, Rock is attacked early, he hurts his ankle at the hands of Farouk, and then he valiantly comes back out to face Farouk and ends up picking up the win. So they do the injury angle, and the Rock prevails anyway. So you don't really remember a lot of strong wins by the Rock in early 1998, but that was actually one of them. Slam and an elbow by Billy Gunn, but Rock gets a blind tag to Owen Hart, who comes into the ring with a dropkick off the top rope. But Billy Gunn answers with a DDT. And Gunn misses a stinger splash into the corner. But instead of hitting the buckle, he was so high up that his head hit the ring post. I'm just going to say close enough. Even if his head didn't actually hit the post, that is what they suggest on commentary. And Owen follows that up with the spinning heel kick, which gets the three count. So everything is moving rather fast here. And The Rock and Owen are both in the ring and kind of cornering Triple H. So this is when China saunters back out to ringside as they go to a commercial break, and there's a near fall as they come back where The Rock gets a two count. Owen tags in a neck breaker by him, and then he hits an elbow off the top rope, but that only gets two because that move sure as hell ain't what it used to be. Owen puts his head down, Triple H with a sunset flip, but a very strange sequence where The Rock is somehow distracting the referee. We don't quite see why that is happening, and you get like a seven count visual pinfall by Triple H because Paul's got to get his visual pinfall over Owen, but Owen does kick out when the actual count is made. Gut-wrench suplex by Owen tags out, and they do a wishbone maneuver on Triple H. Seeing The Rock and Owen together, I just wonder in terms of the mentoring partnership between these two guys. I think it's a little bit more obvious when The Rock is rising in the Nation of Domination. Both former college football players, they have a lot in common. Triple H does fight back, but he's caught with an elbow and a slam. And now we're setting up for the People's Elbow by The Rock, which started out as a thing to make The Undertaker laugh. In recalling The Rock's career, I'm glad that he never hurt his right elbow after the People's Elbow spot. Because they're like, oh, he took the brace off his elbow and threw it into the crowd. And then all of a sudden he hurt that same thing later. This is not a finishing hold at this point. Only a two count. Rock then puts his head down. A cardinal mistake for not quite a ring veteran, but for a guy who's been around a little bit. Triple H answers with a knee because it's all knee-based offense. Rock goes for the rock bottom. Triple H fights out of it and answers with the pedigree for the 1-2-3. And guys are not making saves on the pinfalls because that would only extend this match. And everything is just incredibly compacted. So now we're down to Owen and Triple H. And immediately you see this and you say, okay, clearly Triple H is going to get his win back from the night before. But Owen gains control with the enziguri, and then out of nowhere, Ken Shamrock runs in and attacks Owen Hart for the disqualification. And Shamrock, just back from the, quote, broken ankle at the hands of Owen from Owen's original heel turn in a tag team match a couple of months before, back in April. It was some peculiar timing, given that Shamrock was on the Over the Edge poster. Always kind of interesting when the wrestler who's on the poster doesn't actually appear on the pay-per-view. So Shamrock goes nuts on Owen Hart, and Shamrock's doing his unhinged routine, so that brings in the Nation to help. And now it's a 5-on-1 situation, so Shamrock's in a little bit of trouble, and he does get some assistance from a very unexpected source, as Dan the Beast Severn, his former UFC rival, comes down and cleans house with, and by the way, Severn not wearing his gear. He's wearing basically a shirt and slacks, which is rather humorous. And they have a little bit of a stare down.
The Nation now doing a number on Ken Shamrock. That's Dan Severn. What? Dan the Beast Severn's here. The Nation got him last week. Dan the Beast Severn here.
They're in the ring.
Severn and Shamrock in the ring. Severn and Shamrock. And there's no love lost between these two.
Look at this. This fight ain't over.
The Beast and the world's most dangerous man, and this ain't the Octagon.
At the time, as a fan, I saw these UFC guys as total division killers, to the point where, well, they're legitimate fighters, so why should any of these guys have a chance against them in this setting? But what I forget is, this is professional wrestling, and you're trying to tell a story. So I was very wrong about that, because you can have somebody beat Ken Shamrock and Dan Severn, because this is not the UFC. I do wonder if maybe they could have savaged Dan Severn's time in the WWF by teaming these guys together. I don't know if they got along or if they hated each other or what the deal was, but it might have helped Dan Severn a little bit. Of course, that team would have fed right into my whole division killers thing, because you probably were not going to take the titles off the New Age Outlaws, although at a certain point they probably didn't even really need them. So as Severn leaves to go wipe out a few more Soviet generals, Triple H is back in the ring, and he punks Shamrock because he's very upset over the DQ, not allowing him to get his win back over Owen from the night before, and it's broken up by the officials. And Shamrock once again is doing the unhinged pissed routine, and all the referees and the agents. I see Tony Garea in there. There's no Pat Patterson because he's working that heel gimmick. So Garea's got to do a little bit more. And he has a rather humorous exchange with Ken Shamrock.
Kenny, take it easy.
Get off me!
Knock it off!
Get off me!
Knock it off! What the hell is wrong with you?
Who the hell are you?
Stay out of this!
It's like only the 9th or 10th most notable thing that happened on this show. I think Kenny's just upset because he's got that close-cropped haircut that he always had, and he's never going to have the kind of hair that Tony Garea has, even as Garea was older. Too Close by Next, definitely the greatest song ever written on the subject of accidental boners, was a number one hit this week in 1998 and actually stayed in the top 40 all the way to the end of the calendar year, which, I mean, you want to talk about one hit wonder, that thing was pretty freaking huge. I don't know if Next had another song and nothing comes to mind, so I really can't think of it. So they show Vince in the locker room meeting with Paul Bearer and Kane, and he shakes Kane's hand, kicking off a 20-year relationship. So I guess that's the birth of Kane in the corporation, or corporate Kane. But for our next match, we have Tennessee Lee in the ring introducing his protege, Double J, Jeff Jarrett. And once again, just like last week, where I was confused and befuddled by the level of push he was getting in WCW, remained baffled by Jeff Jarrett in the WWF in 1998, because think back to the end of 97. He leaves WCW, comes into the WWF, does that interview where he says that Triple H is a follower, you know, words that may haunt him later on, and basically badmouths everybody, has the work shoot promo, all that, complaining about the country singer gimmick as the NWA Aztec Warrior Jeff Jarrett that he eventually becomes. And then what does he do? He reverts right back to the freaking country singer thing that he was complaining about in the first place. Ain't he great, is what they were saying. And like, doesn't he suck? I mean, that's pretty much what I was thinking at the time. And I'm just really confused by how quickly they went back to this. And it's funny because this segment, he's following the former roadie who has now surpassed him in terms of overness with the crowd. I mean, they eat up everything that he says, and most people couldn't give a rat's ass about Jeff Jarrett, at least until the point where he cut his hair or he got his hair cut by X-Pac at SummerSlam 98. But that is still a couple of weeks, a couple months away. And Tennessee Lee says those guys in the WWF offices in the North need to learn some lessons from those in the South.
I'm going to give you a little lesson. How about a little justice tonight?
Huh?
Yes, sir. Southern style, ladies and gentlemen, Southern justice.
Got a new singing group? Well, it looks to me like that Tennessee Lee has cleaned up the Godwins. That is the Godwins.
They're wearing suits! So great. So yes, Southern Justice, the repackaged Godwins, coming out to that cool theme that Jeff Jarrett would eventually steal, along with Deborah, because when I hear that theme, I think of Deborah as well. Because Godwin's Law was not doing them any good, because Vince is distracted by Stone Cold Steve Austin, so he can't laugh at the hillbilly act anymore. So it's plain and simple, so now they're rolled out as Southern Justice, which didn't sound to me like a singing group. Kind of sounds like a TV show, like a detective show on CBS. Like, could you just picture Jim Nantz on the Super Bowl, like, coming up after the game, 60 Minutes, followed by an all-new episode of Southern Justice, followed by a brand-new Blue Bloods, only on CBS. I mean, I'm not sure I would actually watch that show, but there probably has been a TV show called Southern Justice. I mean, there's so many cable channels now that there is probably one out there. This is all prequel for the King of the Ring qualifier match between Double J and Farouk. Farouk coming off that loss to Rock the Rock the night before, and with that feud coming to an end, really going to struggle now to find something for Farouk to do, because he's on his own, and it's going to take a little while before he finds a spot in the tag team, the Acolytes, along with Bradshaw, who we're going to see a little bit later, because this was kind of an odd period for him as well. Jarrett attacks early. He gets caught on a corner whip trying to evade over the top, where he goes in face first and then lifts his legs up, tries to leapfrog. There's a "We Want Flair" chant from the crowd, which is very strange. I don't know if this has anything to do with Jarrett's thing with the Horsemen from the year before, but this is during Ric Flair's lengthy hiatus during 1998 when he had the lawsuit with Eric Bischoff, very high profile around this time. And I think the crowd, with their not giving a crap about Double J, they're just going to say what they want. See, this is long before CM Punk, who was just a mere 20-year-old and probably not at the show, even though it was in Chicago area. Farouk, foot to the throat in the corner, but he is caught with a back elbow. Short clothesline by Double J. Short clothesline, also a very popular move this time, 1998. I don't know if it's Jake Roberts' influence or whatever it is. A slam and a leg drop by Farouk, because this match is going back and forth. The crowd is just very distracted, and Farouk goes for two straight pinfalls, which Jarrett kicks out at two. Don't know what that was about, if they just needed to regroup. Farouk goes to the top rope, which is a very peculiar thing in and of itself. He gets crotched, but he's not in trouble for long because he does hit a spine buster. It is not the Arn spine buster because he just grabbed him and dropped him straight down. It's certainly, I think, time to repackage Farouk, because the outfit with the Nation, it's just a reminder. It's like Ricky Morton still wearing the Rock and Roll Express stuff, even though he had split from Robert Gibson. So it's time for him to be wearing something else and not the Ottawa Senators outfit that he was wearing when he originally came in. Southern Justice, now, they get up on the apron. They want to make their presence felt. So Tennessee Lee runs distraction from the other side and hands Jarrett a belt. And I got to tell you, the optics of the end of this match stink, because you have four white guys from the South, and two of them use a belt to beat a black man in the ring. And that is how he picks up the win. Jarrett hits him with the belt buckle. Four Southern whites beating a black man with a belt. The whole thing stinks to high hell, and I hate that I'm covering this on Martin Luther King Day week. So yeah, definitely time to repackage Farouk as Double J advances to the King of the Ring tournament.
As the leader in sports entertainment, the World Wrestling Federation is proud to be at the forefront of charitable and humanitarian causes worldwide. For more than 50 years, the McMahon family has carried on a time-honored tradition of sharing their portion of the American dream with those less fortunate. Led by Chairman Vince McMahon, the World Wrestling Federation now extends to more than 1,000 employees, each who continue the spirit of giving to charities like the Boys and Girls Clubs and the Special Olympics. As the WWF continues to grow into the next millennium, so too will its tradition of compassion and giving.
When I set out to do this show, I knew that around this time they did one of those ads painting Vince as a great humanitarian, which is very tongue-in-cheek, by the way, and it's made fairly obvious by how kind of over-the-top it is. I like the part where he's talking to Tommy Lasorda randomly. I don't know why that made me laugh. So it feels different from the stupid Stephanie McMahon stuff, which just feels like, oh, well, this is there to remind everybody that Stephanie rules over all and all that. This occurring while Vince is being an asshole to the entire roster, it's just so great. And the time-honored tradition, I love that phrase so much. Ever since Vince used it for Brett not doing the job in Montreal, because I'm a weirdo, when I used to go with my friend Bob to this place called Bickford's, which is like a dinery place in New England, I would call the, quote, time-honored tradition, me getting a chicken club in him getting a turkey club with no tomatoes. Just calling that whole concept the time-honored tradition.
Due to the various uncertainties surrounding my position as it relates to the team's new ownership, I've decided to resign as the head coach of the New York Jets. And would like to wish the entire New York Jet organization, the players, the coaching staff, and the new ownership the very best of luck for a prosperous future.
Hey, you can't get on Bill Belichick's case for quitting as the HC of the NYJ, head coach of the New York Jets, because you had Bill Parcells do it shortly before that, then Belichick, and then a year later, after the 2000 season, Al Groh quits to become the head coach of the University of Virginia, which you'd think would be a downgrade from an NFL team, but hey, if that was what he wanted to do. And the 2000 Jets actually weren't a bad team. I think they went 9-7 and ended up missing the playoffs by, I think they lost the last game of the season. So anyway, for our next bout, we have a very odd pairing making their way to the ring. The WWF Light Heavyweight Champion, Taka Michinoku, and his pal Bradshaw. Maybe my favorite incarnation of JBL, which doesn't say a whole lot because I pretty much hate them all, but if there's anything I could like about him, it's him playing the skipper to Taka's Gilligan. Maybe a lot less goofy than Gilligan. Also, I don't think Bob Denver would have taken that bump at the 2000 Royal Rumble where he just hits head first to the floor. And Taka is taking on one of the members of Kai and Tai, Sho Funaki, his nemesis that he would eventually join. And there's a lot of fast-paced offense in this. A lot of springboards. Sho Funaki with the Asuka ass move. I forget what that's called. The one where you jump up and you just kind of hit him with your ass. Miss on a charge. Taka answers with a tornado DDT, but it is blocked into an inverted atomic drop, which I thought was a pretty cool-looking move. Lawler says if Taka loses the title, because Lawler's upset because, you know, he had beaten Brian Christopher for the light heavyweight title in the original tournament, said that if Taka lost this title, he'd be deader than Barry Goldwater, who had died on May 28th, so earlier that week. Kind of a standard bearer of the conservative movement in the United States through the 1950s and into the mid-60s when he was summarily dropped after getting trounced in the 1964 presidential election. But that actually proved to be the swing of the South going from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, which I have to say is a little weird because Goldwater was from Arizona. It's not like he was from Mississippi or Alabama or anything like that. German suplex try by Funaki, and Taka just sort of flips out of it, lands on his feet, follows up with a hurricanrana. Dick Togo runs in, but it is a big swing and a miss. He absolutely misses everything. They end up on the outside, and Taka with the acai moonsault onto everybody. And now the attention is diverted to Al Snow, who was out at ringside dressed as a Japanese photographer, which would be completely racist if there weren't actual Japanese photographers out there. Actually, does that make it more racist or less racist? I really don't know, but he's there with Head, and they're establishing that crazy Al Snow character within the WWF universe after it had been so successful in ECW in the first few months of 1998. It was must-see TV for me every night, every Friday night on the Spanish Channel 27 up here in Massachusetts, and we get a basement dropkick because if you want to be in the WWF light heavyweight division in 1997 and 98, you have to just do basement drop kicks aplenty. It's like my one complaint about the great Sasuke and Taka match from the In Your House Canadian Stampede from the previous July. There's so many of them. He misses on a missile drop kick, and Sho Funaki falls up with a fisherman buster, but he goes up top, misses. Taka responds with a drop kick to the back of Funaki's head, and follows it up with his finisher, the Michinoku Driver number 2. Now, sometimes you wonder, okay, why is it Michinoku Driver number 2? The sort of body slam into, you know, where you spike the guy on his head. The Michinoku Driver number 1, if I remember correctly, is more reminiscent of a Death Valley Driver or a TKO, like what Mark Maron does. I think it's more a Death Valley Driver, but seeing Bradshaw, and he picks up the win with the Michinoku driver number two, seeing Bradshaw with Taka takes me back to 1989 WCW. Shades of the JTEX Corporation with this random Texan hanging out with the Japanese guy, and they seem to have nothing in common. You don't, at least there was money interest there with Hiro Matsuda and Ric Flair and all that. But here, it's a little unclear. It's like, yeah, we want to give Bradshaw something to do, so he's going to be the skipper to Taka's Gilligan.
Little buddy, I want to compliment you.
Thanks, Skipper.
You've really done a fine job. Put her there, pal.
I'd totally watch a buddy comedy where JBL is stranded on a deserted island just as long as he could never get off. So we got Paul Bearer in the back with Kane, and he says that Kane has beaten The Undertaker with nothing at stake, so now he will beat him with the number one contendership on the line, which is a little confusing because Kane hasn't actually beaten The Undertaker, which is something that Jim Ross is going to point out later on commentary. Al Snow is shown talking to Head, who he has put on top of his car out in the parking lot, so he is clearly going a little insane because he's trying to work his way back in, and this is the way they are attempting to reintroduce him. That the magic of the ECW thing, there was just no way that they were going to recapture it exactly the same as it was there. But we get a nice little surprise here and a flashback to the early days of Monday Night Raw, and by early days I mean like the first 5 years, because Vince McMahon has come out to the commentary position, and this is a three-man booth that we can be proud of with Vince, JR, and the King, Jerry Lawler. But first, we're not to our main event quite yet. We have another King of the Ring qualifying match, and this is another one that I remembered greatly from this show. We have Mark Henry of The Nation taking on the GOAT, Terry Funk. And the Funker is so unselfish in this match at the age of 54, and Vince calls Funk the King of Hardcore and makes sure to disparage Mick Foley relative to Terry Funk, because of course he fired him earlier. There's no clean break by Funk at the beginning, because he is the smaller man in the match. He is outweighed by about 150 pounds, three chops laid in, and a neck breaker. He goes for the pin, but Henry does the Power Man kick out where Funk goes way up in the air. Not quite to the level of Randy Savage in the 93 Royal Rumble, but still pretty high in the air anyway. Can't get the neck breaker as Funk goes for it again, so he lays in a low blow via a mule kick to just kind of get his offense in. Reversal of an Irish whip leads to a big clothesline by Mark Henry, which could be called a lariat because he is from Texas, but you don't really think of him as a Texan quite yet because he's not doing the whole hook 'em horns thing. Vince is so amazing on commentary here because, yes, he's this great heel as Mr. McMahon, but he's also, of course, the owner of the company, and he can sell his product and do the sell job on color commentary like nobody else.
And Kane, who has just taken so much of the way of the powers from the dark side away from The Undertaker. Can The Undertaker get him back? How bad does he really want it, you know? Talks a good game. We'll find out just how badly The Undertaker wants to be the number one contender.
I mean, yeah, other announcers can probably do that same sell job, but it's just the dichotomy of him now being this new character and then swooping back in and putting over this Undertaker-Kane match, on, which is a pretty big friggin' deal, because they had the two matches on pay-per-view at WrestleMania, and then I think it was Unforgiven. I don't think it was called Backlash yet, the post-Mania pay-per-view. So it really, you know, it gets me excited to see that match, and I'm not a big fan of the Undertaker-Kane matches, or at least the WrestleMania one. I found that to be the most boring one on that show, and as I was attending WrestleMania 14, I thought, well, Kane's obviously going to win because, you know, clearly, where are you going to go if Undertaker beats him? Of course, it was the three tombstones that were needed to put him away. Funk is on the outside, and he lays in a shot to the gut on Henry and sends him to the guardrail. So Funk gets up on the ropes, and he gets caught on the shoulder of Mark Henry and sent into the ring post. Still on the floor, Funk reverses an Irish whip, and Henry is sent into the ring steps, so he sends the top half of those steps flying. I mean, I think that Funk is kind of teaching Mark Henry a little bit of, like, how to work a match outside of the ring, because Mark Henry had not had a lot of matches to this point, and certainly not anything quite like this. Funk then grabs a chair and hits Mark Henry right on the top of the head, which I can endorse. Although I think I may have mentioned before that I think back then some people might have believed that, well, if you take the chair shot on the very top of your head rather than on your forehead or to the back of the head, you can absorb it better. And no, not exactly. So Funk, because that isn't insane enough, he climbs up on the ropes again and goes for the acai moonsault. And he has a horrific landing where he completely misses and he hits his thigh on the top of the guardrail. And that is not padded and it's not the all-black contraption that they have now. That is more of a steel guardrail that they have. And I'm not sure if Mark Henry was supposed to catch him. I would assume that he should have. But holy crap, it did look like the Terry Funk might have broken his leg on that one. So kind of a bad job by the world's strongest man. Back inside, headbutt by Terry Funk, and then off the ropes, they hit heads. But on a collision like that, the guy who's got the 150-pound edge has the advantage. So Henry is still on his feet. He hits the big splash, but it only gets a two count because Terry Funk is one resilient mofo. Body slam gets two. A running leg drop a la Hulk Hogan, that only gets two for Mark Henry. Terry answers with the flash small package, but that is only a two count as well. So now Mark Henry is mad, so he's going to put this thing away. And the power bomb, a very green-looking power bomb, I might add. And he follows it up with a pretty good-looking big splash. I would give it maybe 7 Big E's out of 10. I like Big E's splash because he gets really high in the air. And it's a lot better than the old tugboat one. So a very unselfish job by Terry Funk, working this match with the relatively inexperienced Mark Henry. Henry did pick up the win with the big splash. A guy who had signed a really long contract in 1996. I believe it was a 10-year deal. So, like I talk about with The Rock, you know, guys coming up in the business, you need those mentors. You need locker room leaders to kind of guide people as they're going through. With The Rock, you had Farooq and probably Owen Hart. And even just in individual matches like this, you have Terry Funk there, the great, the GOAT, guiding Mark Henry, and at the end of the day, putting him over.
Back to the point, Stevens stepped up to hold it in, did. Hull stole it, Stevens holds it in again. Shot it right through the top of the crease. And they are centered, shot, score! The New Jersey Devils have won the Stanley Cup! With the game-winning overtime goal!
Hey, when there's a Stanley Cup-winning goal in overtime, as there was in 2000, Jason Arnott of the New Jersey Devils, I think I'm obligated to play it, especially if it was controversial like the one last week. No controversy there. Devils win over the Stars. Two good teams, but two relatively unwatchable teams, quite frankly. Both defense first and very boring. Now, the Devils would actually change the next year in 2001. People forget that they were a top 3 to 5 team in the league in scoring in 2000-2001. And people just like to focus on the neutral zone trap stuff. But I want to say one interesting fact about the New Jersey Devils and their Stanley Cups in 1995 and in 2000, and I believe in 2003 they did this as well. The Stanley Cup parade, which you'd have through the streets, of the city in which the team plays. So the Rangers went down the Canyon of Heroes in Manhattan. The Bruins went through the streets of Boston on duck boats. All that sort of stuff. The Devils, they played in East Rutherford, New Jersey at that time. And there's no real city to go through because they're not really New York's team. So what did they do? They had a parade around the parking lot of the Continental Airlines Arena, which used to be known as the Brendan Byrne Arena. Right next to where MetLife Stadium is now. So when you're tailgating for WrestleMania 35, just remember that you are on the site of the New Jersey Devils' 3 Stanley Cup parades.
Yeah.
Whoa, whoa, hold up there, JR. As the head of talent relations at this time, you should know that Austin is an independent contractor and not an employee of the World Wrestling Federation, and thus is not eligible for health insurance or any of that. So yeah, the Stone Cold independent contractor is on his way out to an enormous pop because this is the first time he's come out the entire show and we're an hour and 50 minutes in. And he's going to join commentary after he gets up on the turnbuckles at all four corners, shoots Vince the dirty look. And it's big enough that there's an Undertaker Kane match going on here, but we got the beautiful repartee of Austin and McMahon, which I played a little bit of at the very top of the show, but holy crap, is there a lot more of it in this one. There's one other thing that I made a note to point out in seeing the introductions, and I forget who had this happen, and it was probably Kane. This stupid goddamn laser pointers, somebody was pointing it at one of the guys walking out, and I'm like, well, thank God we left those in the 90s where it belonged. When you'd get, like, tickets to wrestling and it would say no laser pointers on them just to really drive home the point. And then smash cut to this past Sunday in the AFC Championship game and somebody is shining a freaking laser pointer at Tom Brady. It's the year 2019, people. Put your freaking laser pointers away. The thing is, it's just so stupid. I can't believe it. Anyway, you get an exchange early, corner whip, and Undertaker with a avalanche stinger splash type move onto Kane. And then The Undertaker, because he's such a weird dude, he stands by the ropes where Paul Bearer is, and he goes backwards as if an invisible man had clotheslined him over the top rope. He lands on his feet, because The Undertaker can do that, and he did all that just to hit Paul Bearer out on the floor, which was actually kind of hilarious. But he hops back in and connects with Old School, because he is still very much capable of walking the ropes at this point. But then Kane catches the throat of The Undertaker and lays on a choke slam. And now we get Vince and Austin with beautiful repartee number one.
This is what the WWF is all about.
Oh, I agree with you, man.
This is what it is.
This is what it's all about.
Yeah.
And in a month from now, that's what it really be all about.
You're
when the WWF
right.
title is on the line.
Okay,
you're
damn right.
Still got the damn title.
Okay, okay.
I don't know. I just love how Austin managed to spit out at the end, I still got the damn title. So, and of course he wouldn't end up with the title because Kane would beat him for it at the King of the Ring. Of all things, short clothesline by Kane outside the ring. He sends The Undertaker into the post. And Austin, make no mistake about it, he doesn't have many allies in the WWF. But Undertaker had come down the night before and just kind of stood guard to make sure that he was going to get a fair shake. And in return, I guess Stone Cold does express a little bit of admiration.
I believe you lit a fire under The Undertaker's ass. I think he is what he used to be. He is the phenom, and I ain't kissing his ass because I ain't all about that. I respect the man because he's a hell of a competitor, and I'd like to face him. On the other hand, I'd just as soon beat Kane's ass.
Yeah.
But I just assume whip Kane's ass. Undertaker does fire up, but then he's caught with a body slam by Kane. And we go back to more Austin and Vince.
He ain't got the smarts of The Undertaker. Undertaker's been around a long time.
Well, I'll grant you that. Maybe too long. Tonight we find out.
Let me tell you something. You might be around too long if you don't shut up. You're starting to get on my nerves now.
Don't tell me to shut up. I own that microphone you're talking into. Don't tell me to shut up.
I respect far side.
Kane catches Undertaker with the big boot, but then tries to follow it up and misses with an elbow, and they slug it out in the center. Kane misses a clothesline, and Undertaker hits him with the chokeslam, but Kane sits up in fairly short order, but when he gets back to his feet, the Undertaker hits him with a Russian leg sweep. A new trick from the old dog, as Austin put it. But that's just because The Undertaker used to watch Virgil matches in the early 90s and saw him do the Russian leg sweep. So this is kind of a tribute spot to Vincent over in WCW. Maybe an overture to him to come back. And then another overture to a member of the NWO, the running leg drop. But because Undertaker is not Hogan, it only gets two. We do the double do-si-do reversal of the Irish whip where the ref is inexplicably standing in the corner and he gets bumped. So Undertaker now takes the opportunity to hit the tombstone, but of course, there is no referee. Stone Cold has a good idea how to resolve this, though.
Robert, you're the owner, Vince. Go count the damn count. One, two, three. Get off your ass, show some guts. Show some initiative.
Well, I mean, Vince's last experience refereeing wasn't all that positive, so I think he's not very eager to jump back in there. So it is at that point you hear JR yelling at the end, where Mick Foley, wearing a red jacket for some reason, and his Mankind gear, shows up at ringside and gets Undertaker in the mandible claw for a little bit. Now, if I had to rebook this in some way, I might have had Foley come out on a zip line, but that's only because I'm a mark for zip lines, and it would be funny to see this near 300-pound guy on one of them. So he's got the mandible claw on the Undertaker, and Vince reiterates that he's fired him, but he starts to have a little bit of second thoughts. The Undertaker eventually does fight out of it, and he clotheslines Kane, who then sits up from it. So a lot of the same characteristics between Kane and The Undertaker, which was always a very nice touch whenever these guys would feud, especially early on. I mean, eventually, like all things, like the song Hotel California, it just gets completely effed out after a while, and you just get kind of sick of it. And Foley gets back up on the apron, and The Undertaker knocks him into the guardrail, which I'm going to say is a Bret Hart tribute spot, because that was the one Bret would go from the apron into the guardrail. But thanks to that distraction, Kane catches The Undertaker, tombstones him, and instead of doing the arms crossed thing like The Undertaker would do, differentiate it, he had The Undertaker's arms spread and he held down his arms. And the revived referee counts 1, 2, and 3. And Kane is the victor over The Undertaker, and will face Stone Cold Steve Austin at the King of the Ring in Pittsburgh on June 28, 1998. We get a little bit of a post-mortem where Vince has decided that Kane is his man because he shook his hand in the locker room, and he's going to trash-talk Austin and gloat. So as you can imagine, Austin is flipping off Vince, leaning over to really get it right in his face. I blame Austin for my tendency to flip people off when I'm driving. I really should knock that off, because you never know who the other person might be. Definite character flaw on my part. So now Mankind, who is called as such, and The Undertaker are brawling at ringside. And the beauty of this booking is you've set up your main event, Kane and Austin, which is an entirely new matchup. And then you have Kane, The Undertaker versus Mankind, an old matchup, but a classic one, The Undertaker's best opponent in the WWF to that point, and you're going to put it in the Hell in the Cell structure, which I'm sure is structurally sound, and that everybody is going to work the safest spots possible, and nobody is going to come out of it, with horrible injuries. I can only imagine. So Vince, seeing the moxie, and there's no better word for what Mick Foley, Mankind, is doing right now, he's kind of changing his mind on firing him right here at the tail end of the show. So it's a nice little bookend there, too.
I may change my mind about Mick Foley. Mick Foley is showing me some intestinal fortitude here. He's showing me some guts.
You might not fire him after all.
Mick Foley, look what he's doing to The Undertaker. Foley.
And that is why you would have a Hell in the Cell match. Not because it's October and the name of the pay-per-view happens to be called that, and then you force 3 matches into the cell. You do it because it's a blood feud with very high stakes. JR may make sure to say, maybe they'll have to settle this in hell. So good job by him to sneak in that line as Undertaker and Mankind fight down under the ring. And that is it. That is how they wrap for my favorite episode of Raw of all time, June 1st, 1998. Before I get to my reflective thank yous at episode number 100, I just remembered that I owe you my GWWE Tag Team Top 5 Teams of All Time. And it's rather interesting as I go through this list, because if you look at all the shows that I've done, I've only covered years through 1977 through 2001. So you think, well, do you watch the modern product? How do you rank it versus the old days? Well, I have a certain appreciation for it because you're going to see three modern teams in my top five GWWE ballot. Number five, the Revival. And they came along in 2015. I was so happy that a team was doing Midnight Expressy and Arn and Tully type stuff in matches that were very thoughtful. Like they were watching stuff from the 80s the same way I do on a daily basis and just kind of studying it and learning from that. And they had so many great tag matches in NXT over the last several years. It's a mystery to me why the main roster has not made use of them, especially because they're on Raw and not SmackDown, which has a much more crowded tag division. So I hope that maybe someday they will break through, even if it's not in WWE, if it's somewhere, because those two guys, Dash Wilder and Scott Dawson, definitely deserve it. Number four, the Rockers. They're body of work is, I mean, they got a 4.5-star match out of the Powers of Pain, which tells you everything you need to know about where they stand as miracle workers. They were so good against a variety of opponents, running from the Twin Towers at WrestleMania 5 to the Rougeaus and some of those 60-minute matches that they had on house shows. And the one match versus the Hart Foundation was kind of a disaster from the Saturday night's main event that got released later on. The Hart Foundation is at number three, and maybe it's my bias of Brett over Shawn that has that ranking taking place, but I just like their work a little bit better than the Rockers. At number two is the Usos, and they get huge points for longevity, having been a team for almost 10 years, and their body of work, especially over the last five, has been just crazy good, especially once they kind of moved away from the kid-friendly characters and into the heelish characters in 2016, where they're having, you know, wrap-offs against the New Day and stuff like that. And my number one tag team of all time, trying to do a drum roll, but I really can't because it's just a crappy hotel pen. The Bar, Cesaro and Sheamus, are my number one team of all time in WWE, in part because they have everything I want out of a tag team. They're two power guys, but they're not plodding or slow. They can do any kind of match that you might want them to do, and I've enjoyed literally everything they've done. And yes, that might be a controversial pick. How can you pick those guys over blah, 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 or blah, blah, blah? To which I would say, didn't you hear me last week when I said that if Cesaro had teamed with a dead squirrel from Route 110 in Massachusetts, that I would have ranked them in the top 35? So, Sheamus, way better than a dead squirrel. And I mean that as the highest possible compliment. Although, his hair is probably worse than a dead squirrel. So, at episode 100, there are so many people that I need to thank by name and by category and whatever. First person I want to thank is the voice of greetings from Allentown, Keith E. Langston, the part inspiration of this show. Yeah, I do this show for myself, but I also like to think of what Keithy would like in terms of what I'm talking about. And he's been on the show a couple times, reading Bible verses, talking Jim Duggan, some stuff like that. He'll be back in the future. I also want to thank Kelly Nelson of the WorldCast podcast and the Titans of Wrestling, specifically because it was him who brought me into the fold of the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And you probably wouldn't have heard this without Pro Wrestling Only. That is where my show actually started to get a lot more listeners, which was after the first 15 episodes, started with episode 16 on WCW Worldwide from 98. But I also have to thank Joe Morata and Michael Quinn of the Our Vantage Point podcast. They've also helped me, I guess, boost my listenership over time with their plugs each week. And I encourage you to listen to their show, which is released on Mondays. Also on Mondays, when you're done listening to that, the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Ring of Honor's own Brian Malonis, one half of the Bouncers, and they've done a lot for my show as well. Not to mention, Crockett got me into a couple of Chaotic shows for free. I always appreciate free stuff. I will remember you forever. Like, somebody buys me a pizza, I'm like grateful 20 years later. It's so good. And hopefully if I make it to that ROH show at Madison Square Garden, as I am planning to, hopefully Malonis and the Beer City Bruiser will be there on the card. Who knows, maybe winning or defending the ROH tag team titles. Time will tell. Also, Steve Bennett, my frequent podcast partner on the Adams Division podcast, which we do have a Royal Rumble special coming up. It'll come out after the Royal Rumble because life sometimes gets in the way of taping schedules. Going back to New York this weekend for a baby shower. There will be no post-game show for that one, I have to tell you that. But Steve has been a huge advocate for my show on message boards and Reddit and all that sort of stuff. And I encourage that for you. I'm sort of crowdsourcing my, marketing, if you will, because it's really just me putting all this out. Like, I write the show descriptions. I edit the audio. It's mostly just me talking here. And, you know, I pull my own clips, stuff like that. So, you know, with the marketing aspect of it and, you know, getting on the bullhorn, yeah, I guess I could toot my own horn. But also, you know, word of mouth is an effective way as well. Also, want to thank Place to Be Nation, JT Rosero, Scott Criscolo, haven't had me on their show as the Saturday Night's Main Event correspondent at least a half dozen times now. In fact, I was on there last Monday covering the Saturday Night's Main Event from January of 1989. That is the one with the Red Rooster versus Tito Santana, which I know it's not your main event there, but it's the one with George Steinbrenner sitting in the front row and conversing with Bobby Heenan during it. Also, the Outlaw Ron Bass versus Bruce the Barber Beefcake haircut match. I've also received technical assistance from many people. Joe Morata has weighed in on audio quality, as has Mike Crockett. We probably talked about that during a Chaotic show, standing there for 2 hours. But also want to thank Richard Land for his assistance in just generally actually being single-handedly responsible for some shows actually happening. I'm thinking of one a while back, a November of 85 WWF show, where I had a few issues and Richard reached out to me and helped me out, and I am forever grateful for that. Also want to thank all the YouTube uploaders who have uploaded anything that I've used on for shows that I've done. There's so many of them, and some of them have departed from YouTube, but also need to thank the award-winning WWE Network for making it so easy and accessible to be a fan of not just pro wrestling in general, but for very, like, when have I been able to check out 1984 episodes of Mid-South so easily? And of course, I want to thank everybody who listens to Greetings from Allentown, everybody that I've interacted with on Twitter, Facebook, SoundCloud, what have you, or if I've never interacted with you at all and you just enjoy listening to the show. I certainly appreciate your support, and especially doubly so if you do reach out and spread the word and tell one person who tells one person, then you just slowly build from there. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much. I can't believe that I got to 100 episodes. My goal in the beginning was 63 episodes. I explained why back at episode 63, because a podcast that I really enjoyed ended at 63 episodes back in 2011, and then it came back in 2018, oddly enough. So for episode 101, because I am going to keep going as long as I'm enjoying doing this. And I enjoy it more today than I did in the very beginning when I was very concerned about what am I going to say about Harley Race from 1986 as he jumps to the WWF and just kind of planning it all out. It's a lot more stream of consciousness and enjoyable in that sort of way. So next week, episode 101, there's been recent uploads to the WWE Network of Superstars, finally. When it was on 24/7, it's like, okay, why is it not on the network? But the important thing is that it's there now, So I'm going to pick one, even though I already covered one back episode 77 from June 6, 1992. I am going to take a look at the October 31st, 1992 edition of Superstars, which is loaded with lots of stuff happening, such as the Natural Disasters versus Money Inc. for the tag team titles. The Natural Disasters are defending those titles. And that's sort of cheating because that originally aired on Wrestling Challenge. So you're going to get Gorilla and Bobby on that one. A couple of debuts, Yokozuna's in-ring debut, and the first sighting of Doink the Clown, and also the return of that hideous coward, Marty Jannetty, attacking Shawn Michaels. And unlike the version that you'd see on the award-winning WWE Network, I'm going to cover a version that has event centers hosted by Sean Mooney for an upcoming show at the Boston Garden, because damn it, that's the way I want to do things on Greetings from Allentown, even though at the very beginning I was going to skip over event centers and promos, which I can't even imagine how this show would be if I did that, because that's like the most entertaining part. When you get Ted DiBiase talking about making Kerry Von Erich his manservant, as if that would work out in any galaxy or whatever. But again, thank you so much. Spread the word. Leave a 5-star review on iTunes or Apple Music or whatever the hell it's called this week for Greetings from Allentown. And also for the Pro Wrestling Only feed as well. And tune in next Thursday for episode 101 of Greetings from Allentown.
What have you done for Vince McMahon lately?